have you with us this morning. I'm your host, Dr. Rick Klofein. Temple of Health Radio Show is brought to you by Plastico Surgery Center and Millennium Healthcare, our holistic practices in Atlanta, Georgia. My co-host, Dr. Susan Kolb, can't be with us today, and she'll be missed because we always appreciate her input. Millennium Healthcare is our group holistic medical practice in Atlanta. I'm a board-certified gynecologist practicing in Atlanta 20 years, and I've been associated with Millennium Healthcare for the last 8 years. It's been a very good association because it holds a good container for my work and what I want for myself. Through our radio show, Temple of Health, we're able to have the opportunity to interview those individuals, those authors, that have had a impact on our work and an impact on our lives. That means we generally interview people in topics of general medicine, alternative and integrative medicine, metaphysics, spirituality and the interface between spirituality and medicine, new science. We get to talk to the most fascinating people. And that's why I'm happy to have back on our show Joseph Chilton Pierce, the author of many books. We've already had him on the show for The Biology of Transcendence and The Crack in the Cosmic Egg. So when I was told that I was scheduled to interview Joe again, I was very pleased, and the book I was handed was Spiritual Initiation and the Breakthrough of Consciousness, The Bond of Power. Joseph Chilton Pierce is a scholar, a scientist, an educator. I would call him a world-renowned thinker and author. I would also personally consider him a mystic, and from the onset of his career, he's been an advocate of the evolution of child-rearing practices and an examination of how our child-rearing practices influences our ability to attain spiritual maturity within our lifetime. His expertise spans a broad range of disciplines. The current book that I was given to interview him with was written many years ago, in 1981, and it involves topics that I happen to be very personally interested in, and I'll be interested to hear Joe's take many years later, and I also invite him to lead our conversation in whatever, down whatever path he would like. I'm very flexible. The book is about relationship with a spiritual teacher in the 1970s, and it has to do with certain Eastern concepts that I have relate to in my life, having to do with the nature of the universe and Shakti and spiritual energy and divine feminine energy, having to do with relationships to spiritual teachers and gurus and what that relationship is all about and that teaching is all about. I'm very happy to have with us today Joseph Chilton Pierce. Joe, thank you for being here again.
Well, thank you for having me, Dr. Rick. And I must say, it's always a surprise to have that rather ancient book brought to mind again.
Yes, I was surprised myself when I didn't schedule the show, and they handed me the book, and I said, 1981. That was very interesting that they handed me a book to interview you. Usually we're interviewing authors with books just coming out.
Well, I'll tell you about the one that came out about 2 years ago called
Yes.
The Death of Religion and Rebirth of Spirit.
Yes.
And the byline or the subheading was Rediscovering the Intelligence of the Heart. And that's what I was talking about back then in 1981. It was this business of the connection between the brain, mind, and the heart. And since then, believe me, the information about the connection between the brain and mind and the heart has really grown enormously. I guess every book I've written since, 1991, I came out with Evolution's End, which was centering almost entirely on this business of the intelligence in the heart, and bringing the intellect of mind and brain into alignment with the intelligence of the heart. And I'm still on that same general theme today, but I must say the issue has grown enormously. The research has been breathtaking, particularly in the past 10 years. And all of it related to both spirituality, health, and certainly with child rearing. I think of David L. Kine just recently in a public address said to the audience, you know, we have learned more through research in the past 10 years concerning the growth of the brain and all in the child than any culture has ever known before in history. And then L. Kine paused and he said, and point for point, we in the United States do exactly the opposite of what research tells us.
It's quite amazing.
So Rick, I throw that one out just as a comment, because our research always certainly goes far beyond public practice or social practice. And that, as you know, has to do with health, spirituality, child rearing, and all the rest of it. It's always, it seems that the public and their attitudes fall behind. They're a little late in catching on. And so all I've been doing, I guess I've given about, all in all, a couple of thousand addresses to audiences concerning the relation of the brain and the heart over the past 35, going on 40 years.
So I think this distinction is so important, threaded through your work and threaded through our lives. This distinction between brain, mind, and heart. And it feels to me like our culture has a very long brain leg and a very short heart leg and is limping terribly.
I love that. What a metaphor, what an image that prints. Well, good for you, right? I certainly think that's true. It's treading on your territory here, and I hope I'm not treading on your toes, but we had a conference over in at Cambridge University, Cambridge a year or so ago, called the Birthlight Conference. Cambridge professor put it on. I think she lost her shirt doing so. But we had people from all over the world there on the issue of birthing.
Yes.
And breastfeeding. And it was really quite interesting, the fact that we have such a really difficult time getting people to really give conscious heed to such practices as birthing, and above all, the breastfeeding. I just found in the new, I believe it was Harper's or Atlantic magazine, just out, a very professional-sounding intellectual lady poo-pooing the idea of breastfeeding. After having had two breastfed children, she had quit trying with the third. And the reason being, it just takes too much time from a professional woman's life in this busy day and time. And probably the research showing all of its benefits is pretty flawed to begin with. And so I was kind of amused at that as she was saying, us busy professional women don't have time to breastfeed, and in the same way we can assume that they probably don't have time for most child care and are going to turn it over to some professional.
Yes.
So I'm going to get off that, because that's one.
Well, I think it's a reflection, your comment. Or a reflection of our general disconnect from our natural selves, and which is the natural world as well, and our disconnect from how important all of these issues are, not just on a personal basis, but on a basis of humanity as a species. And the disconnect from relating to our children in a natural way, which is bonding with them deeply on multiple levels, is a unfortunately self-reinforcing error that occurs.
Yeah, it sets up a kind of a reciprocal feedback,
yeah.
Negative feedback on many different hands. I remember the McCarrison Medical Society over in England. They brought me over there 2 or 3 times, given an address at Oxford and various places. Really smart bunch. And they were talking about the critical need of both bonding and nurturing of children, and how it was both those things, bonding and the nurturing. We're not just talking about breastfeeding. Nurturing is a far greater subject than just nursing, although it includes that. But they went on to talk about one of the errors that we in the West make is in thinking that a high standard of living is a key to having a brilliant, intellectual, intelligent child. And the McCarrison Medical Group went on to say that standard of living has nothing to do with the development of intelligence in children, whereas quality of life has everything to do with the development of intelligence. And after hearing one of their spokesmen on this, of course, the audience finally said, but what defines quality of life? And this marvelous doctor, lady doctor, said, for a child, quality of life is to be loved and wanted by one significant person. She said, it takes only one, and it's so cheap. And I thought, and yet, that quality of life for a child is getting to be more and more rare all the time. So, if you, as a gynecologist, I'm curious about what you find the attitude of the average woman toward her own birth processing and so forth.
So, thank you very much for asking. I practice, so for the last 8 years, I have not practiced hospital medicine. I quit hospital medicine 8 years ago, but for 13 years before that, I did have first in a small group, and then for 8 years I had a solo practice of obstetrics and gynecology. Busy practice, I delivered about it wasn't that busy, but for a solo practice, I delivered 15 babies a month and saw many women in the office and operated out of 3 hospitals. I primarily worked out of 1 hospital. And I found a great variation. I practiced in suburban Atlanta. I was fortunate to a degree because I was a holistic physician and I had a reputation as being open-minded and being knowledgeable about many things. So many women who sought me out literally sought me out rather than just looking in a book, an insurance book for a doctor. So my population might have been a little bit skewed from the general population. But I found that there was a wide range of how women related to their birth processes. It seemed that one of the reasons I loved practicing that form of obstetrics in a hospital was that I felt very honored to be able to try to protect my patients through that experience. So that was one of the reasons I enjoyed those years of practice, is because I was able in many ways to hold safe space for my patients as they tried to traverse the experience of having a child in a hospital in America. I also found that the women who approached this process in a state that I would call an empowered surrenderment, meaning that they were empowered enough to do what they could to make this process what they wanted, but they were surrendered enough to understand that this was a dragon that could not be grabbed by the tail and controlled, that it was something that had to be surrendered to. So it was, quite a wide variety of viewpoints that I saw women have toward the experience.
I have a medical friend, Jack Travis. He's in Australia, comes over here quite often. And he and I have been doing just a little amateurish kind of research on women who give birth to extremely developed children and extremely alert and intelligent children. And most of them, and I know this sounds like hocus pocus, but most of them, of these children, have an enlarged prefrontal cortex. And that, of course, is the latest evolutionary addition to our neural structure in our head. And as I could rattle off all the authorities that talk about the prefrontal cortex being the whole key to what it is to be a real civilized human being, and the key to all creativity and intelligence and science.
And the difference between us and other creatures on Earth.
Oh, yes, indeed. We have that prefrontal cortex, and the rest of them don't. And it's a critical issue. And the fact, as they found at the Santa Barbara Graduate School, which is entirely devoted to pre- and perinatal psychology and health out in Santa Barbara, California, that if a mother is in a very strong emotional state, that is, if she's one of the, what I call these women that own themselves and are inner-directed rather than outer-directed and jerked around like puppets on strings, if they own themselves and take their own inner intuitions and knowledge of their heart, they give birth to a remarkably advanced child. And Travis has been researching this all over the world because he has an international outfit going. And he finds it's the case. When you run across one of these children with enlarged prefrontal cortex and tremendous development and intelligence, he said, I can draw you a personality profile of their mother without even seeing her. He said, I know probably what her general profile would be like. And that sounds like an extreme statement. But I have a friend, Marcy Axness, at the Santa Barbara Graduate School, who is now saying that a preconceptual, we know that the prenatal emotional state of the mother influences the child's own development in utero and certainly afterward. But they've been doing some really interesting research to show that the preconceptual emotional state of the mother enters into, can't say it's a direct one-to-one cause-effect, but it enters into the type of both conception and prenatal experience you'll have and the development of her child. And I think when we start looking at this, we're really discovering some very ancient old wives' wisdoms. But it's fascinating to find it happening on quite a scale today. And I'm sure you're familiar with all of this and the tremendous importance of the bond that forms and the bond that forms between mother and infant, of course, forms in utero. I'm sure you're no doubt familiar with the work of Alan Shore. He's at the School of Medicine at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA School of Medicine. And he turned out a book called, Affect Regulation and the Origin of Self. But in that, he goes into this whole business of the development of these higher areas of the brain and how there are certain critical periods in which this child must be nurtured and cared for, or there is literally actual neural impairment. And the neural structure of the child can be compromised within the first 20 months of life, in ways that will affect that individual for the rest of their life. And so more and more we're beginning to find that our response to parenting and all of that enters in more and more into what our culture and society end up expressing. And as I've said, that from the information that's come out since about 1998 along this line, if we could get a whole one generation of parents willing to take the trouble to follow through, it could change the whole history of the species practically in one short generation. Instead, it's pretty much splinter groups so far.
Yes. Little pockets.
Yes.
It's interesting when you start to talk about preconceptual influence, not prenatal, but preconceptual influence. It always brings back, when I think about that, into my mind the physical fact that when I see a woman, and she was a fetus in her mother, before she was a fetus in her mother, the stuff of which she was made, the egg, was in her mother throughout her entire life from before her mother's birth. As a matter of fact, when her mother was a fetus in her grandmother, the stuff from which she was made, the eggs were forming in her fetal mother's ovaries, so the stuff of which she was made literally, physically existed in her grandmother.
Oh, indeed. You know, that's in this current book that I'm working on. This current book I'm working on, I get into this whole Darwinian evolutionary business and how nature operates by huge profusion. She never does anything small time, but massive profusion. And out of that massive profusion, there's a high degree of selectivity. And I mentioned the very thing you were talking about, that at birth, the female has anywhere from 5 to 7 million potential eggs, that is, folded DNA, all proper, they're ready to be encased, on her ovaries at birth. But that then, by the time the woman is reaching adolescence and maturity and ovulation is ready to begin, it's down to about 400,000,
right.
Just
yep.
A handful. And then, of course, in the process of selectivity, it goes on and on and on until there's an amazing discard continually taking place as nature finds those combinations of DNA that best fit the environment of that time. It's a breathtaking thing. And I'm also in this book kind of laughing about the argument between the creationists and the Darwinians, because evolution is creation itself, and all creation is evolutionary. And so the two are what I call a strange loop. They give rise to each other.
They might be more mutually dependent than mutually exclusive.
Oh, they're absolutely they're mutually reciprocally interdependent, surely.
Yes. Yes.
And so that's to me, this whole process of the development of the human is the most breathtaking, awesome, spiritual, divine kind of a thing you can think of. And boy, it's something to approach with real seriousness.
No, I think that this aspect of the physical, the egg, the physical substrate from which we come, existing throughout our mother's life in her body,
mm-hmm.
Shows us that her life has an impact. That egg is embedded in the substance of her.
Mm-hmm.
Her experience of life, her emotional experience of life, how she's nurtured or not nurtured, determines the biochemical and hormonal milieu of her blood that informs every tissue in her body throughout a lifetime. So I think that her experience preconceptionally can have impact. I mean, just if you just look at it, just in this subjective world, objective world of science and so forth, how can you not see that that could have impact?
Well, one of the interesting things about all this, and I'll declare, I think it can be reversed. That is, I think of one particular lady I know of, the World War II, what do they call them, right after the war, that big outcropping of birth.
The boomers?
The baby boomers.
Yeah.
She was a baby boomer of just the most unfortunate kind, delivered by a highly too intelligent lady, very nervous and so forth. A terrible hospital delivery, didn't even attempt to breastfeed, and 9 months later, here came another one. And each one kind of a disaster, 6 of them in all. And believe me, you're talking about someone who was totally unnurtured. This dear lady was.
Yes.
But at age 35, having wanted a child for years, she conceived, and did everything right.
Mm-hmm.
And above all, it was a perfect delivery with a nurse midwife at home, and doesn't have to be at home, it could have been anywhere. And this tremendous thing happened to her. For one thing, she said it was the most ecstatic experience she's ever had in life.
Yes.
She claimed at age 35, having her first child, that there was no pain, that it was an ecstatic thing from beginning to end, and when the child was born, I was happy to be there. And when the child was born, she was the most excited single person you've ever seen in your life. And before the day was over, she put the child in a snuggly, driven to town and back with this tremendous energy, just driving the whole household. And did she breastfed for 3.5 years. Now, the thing of it is, in doing all of that, that whole train of events, that whole kind of inherited disaster, was simply reversed.
Yes.
One generation doing it right can reverse the whole trend of these negative fields that get going, that could reverse all that right off the bat. And I think that's an important thing for people to realize, along with just what you're talking about, that you might say the inherited negative response we're having to deal with, and yet the tremendous plasticity of this genetic system and reproductive system of our own, and how that plasticity can bring about a radical change in our child.
I agree. I think there's an inherent drive. The inherent drive towards homeostasis is towards wholeness and wellness and back to fulfilling our true nature. So even though these negative impacts are present, I think within us is the inherent remembered wellness.
Oh, I love that term. That's exactly right. The system is always trying to come back to wholeness.
Yes.
And I think it takes a surprisingly small amount of simply heeding and going along with that incredible intelligence.
Yes.
That we've inherited, going along with it rather than trying to constantly outwit it.
Yes.
Or use it for some ego purpose of our own. But this business of being willing and allowing the whole process to unfold in a state of excitement. By the way, let me, you probably have heard this, and I'm carrying coal to Newcastle. But at that Birthlight conference over there in Cambridge, England, a couple of years ago, one of the hottest subjects being discussed by the women themselves, us men felt kind of lost in this one, they were talking about orgasmic childbirth.
Yes, orgasmic birth.
And they were all talking about the discovery that if they would completely relax and go with each contraction, it was never a painful contraction, but would go into an orgasm. And I got to thinking, boy, they better be careful or they'll be censored off the block. But the other, then that was, and we had women after women and midwives and nurse midwives and doctors all saying the same thing, that they had found that when their women went into a state of complete acceptance and willingness and going along, that orgasmic childbirth was far more common than we might think, and followed by orgasmic nursing. And I think those two things are just what you're talking about. The system is built for wholeness and harmony and all the good things, and can be brought back to balance with only, I would say, almost a minimum of effort.
More like just getting out of the way and it will happen.
That's right.
Rather than needing any effort. The movement of orgasmic birth, my personal experience, while not being that directly of orgasmic birth, totally confirms and totally is consistent with this whole thing. This comment I made before, and what you said about the woman giving birth and not experiencing pain, and the comment I made before about women who entered the process in a state of empowered surrender. It's very clear when I saw women who were able to approach it in this way, that labor was an altered, non-ordinary state of consciousness for them, where they fell into the flow of the process. And while I'm not sure the women I was seeing were having an orgasmic birth, they were having an empowered and surrendered labor experience and birth, where it was not painful in the sense of pain they'd experienced other times in their life. And they were in the flow of the process and totally altered. Their state of consciousness was non-ordinary and altered until the moment the baby came out and arrived, when they would completely come clear and present, completely shift in a matter of moments, and be completely clear and present and in the moment and completely present with the baby.
Yes.
Just so amazing to watch.
It's a matter of the we think of the ability of the prefrontal cortex to bring the whole system to a point, single point of attention. And when you bring everything to a single point of attention and intent and attention both coming together at that point, then the lady switches from her attention to the whole birth process, to the result of it. And immediately you had this profound bond with that little infant, and they're all cued for it as well. They're looking out there for exactly the same thing. And when they get it, boy, do they lock in on it with intent and attention. As you know, to lock eyes with a newborn infant is one of the most truly mystical experiences that you can have. That sounds like so much BS, but
it's the truth.
It is certainly the truth. And it also then you've locked in a bond that will never be broken. And I think to bring all this out into the open is really critically important.
Yes.
And it's happening. My daughter, by the way, was graduating from St. John's College a number of years back. And all of a sudden, she's decided she wants to go into she wants to be a nurse midwife.
Yes.
And she's is now going back to take all sorts of science credits in college so that she can get her degree in nursing in order to be better equipped to deal with the whole situation.
Yes.
The fur thing. And I told her, I said, well, why not concentrate on home birthing and so on? And she said, no, it's the women in the hospitals that need the support. And I thought that was an interesting comment.
I think it's probably true. That's how, I mean, I felt very, you know, women who are having home birth are, in general, very educated and very well informed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily always true. Joseph, we're going to take a quick break here.
Right.
Joe, we're speaking with Joseph Chilton Pierce, on many topics, not any particular book. What was the most recent one you wrote?
Well, the most recent was The Death of Religion and Rebirth of Spirit. And I said, I've been waiting for somebody to blow my head off over that one, but so far I haven't been attacked. And that rebirth of spirit is no joke. It's really happening.
And we're going to take a quick break. This is Tim Om, Dr. Rick Klofein. This is Temple of Health Radio Show, and we'll be back shortly.
So you had plastic surgery. What was it like?
It was great. Don't get me wrong. It was surgery, but the doctors and staff at Plastico's were terrific.
Honey, you look like $1 million. You actually went to Plastico's and had it done.
Why don't you? Plastic surgery is outpatient, and you'll only be out of work a few days. I love what Plastico's did for me, and looking my best is an investment that pays in so many ways. The help you get from the professionals at Plastico's is a bargain.
Plastico's, 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available, 770-457-4677. Headaches, back pain, migraines, joint pain, nothing worse than the nagging, unending discomfort of daily aches and pains. If you have pain and are looking for more natural solutions to eliminate your pain, Millennium Healthcare is for you. Millennium Healthcare's professionals will work for you. For help or more information on natural pain relief, call Millennium Healthcare at 770-390-0012. That's 770-390-0012. Millennium Healthcare. Pain relief naturally.
You had plastic surgery, Bill?
You bet I did. I got tired of the wrinkles around my eyes and decided to have Plastico's do something about them.
But I didn't think men had plastic surgery.
Get with it, Bob. Men want to look their best, too. There's nothing wrong with getting a little help from Plastico's to look on top of your game. A lot of guys are doing it, my friend.
Well, I don't know about this.
Look, you see the difference Plastico's made with me. I look better and I feel better. My Plastico's surgery was an investment in me.
So where is Plastico's?
Plastico's is in Dunwoody. Plastico's is staffed by pros who guarantee you personal attention. The Plastico's number is 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available. 770-457-4677.
This is Dr. Rick Klofein. Welcome back to Temple of Health Radio Show. Temple of Health Radio Show is brought to you by Plastico Surgery Center and Millennium Healthcare. We have offices in Atlanta to serve you. You can reach us at 770-390-0012. Also on the web at www.templeofhealth.ws. We're pleased to bring you services every month to the community. We have our radio show coming April 4th, Saturday. That'll be Norm Shealy will be back on, and he'll be on speaking on the medical renaissance period, the secret code. Norm's always an interesting interview. On the 11th of April will be Laura Alden Cam and her book, Unlocking Your Intuitive Power. On the 18th of April, we'll have Daniel Benor back on. This time, Dr. Benor will be speaking on his book, 7 Minutes to Natural Pain Release. And on the 25th of April will be David Riley and The Soul Purpose. Our Noetic Science meeting is the third Thursday of every month at the main office in Dunwoody. On the 16th of April, there will be a free lecture on the soul purpose by David Riley in coordination with his show. There's a free pranic healing community clinic on Sunday, the 19th at 2 o'clock. For information, please call 770-457-4677. We're pleased to provide you with multiple services at our medical offices, again on the web, www.templeofhealth.ws. We're speaking with Joseph Chilton Pierce, author and scientist, mystic. And do you have any contact information you want to provide to our listening audience?
No, Rick, I appreciate it very much. But I'm really kind of retreating to a
yes.
great extent right now, particularly now when I'm trying to get this book written. I'm now 83, going on 84, and I'm not as flexible as I used to be.
And where do you live?
I live in the Blue Ridge. I live in Nelson County, Virginia, which is about 30 miles south of the University of Virginia in Charlotte.
So beautiful. This is beautiful,
yeah.
The beautiful part of the country.
Yes, it's a pretty stretch of the world. I've had a home here for 32 years, although I spent 10 winters and 2 summers in a spiritual ashram in India with my family.
Yes.
And I still do a good bit of traveling, but it's nowhere near what I used to do. But this business of, back one last thing about this childbirth or bonding with one's infant as nature designed, that it really gives, it's a rebirth for the parent. The parent goes through literally a rebirth experience of their own in going along with nature in the birth of their own child. And when we think of parenting, and Lord, I'm tired of that title, in fact, because there's so many books on parenting coming out. But through the action of true parenting, one gets a chance, in effect, to go through all the developmental stages as an adult, in a kind of a peripheral way, so that constantly, if you're truly parenting your child, you're rebuilding a new life within yourself. And I think that's always important, that to realize that bringing a child up in this world isn't just some hard task, but is a tremendously enlightening experience for the parent. I think, again, of being present when this infant came into the world and I locked eyes with it. That infant told me everything there was to know in that split moment. That I'm picking that up from years ago in Carlos Castaneda, who spoke of a coyote locking eyes with him and telling him everything there was to know. And, of course, that really does happen with that new infant coming into the world. Locking eyes with it tells you everything there is to know in some strange kind of a mystic way. And then going along, I think of home, some people are homeschooling their children. And they find that in homeschooling their child, the challenge is tremendous, and they themselves learn more from it than the child does, practically. And these are just the many ways in which when we really give ourselves over to the task of this new life coming into the world, we ourselves are made over in every respect. Does that make any sense?
It makes sense to me, and also comment on the power of the newborn. The power of the newborn, we were just talking before, there's a field around newborns, that when you enter that field, it has an impact on almost everybody. It changes how they feel about themselves, and it changes how they feel about situations. I have seen families at war for many years melt and come to truce through the power of a newborn. Families that were very unhappy, very commonly in the where I practiced, it had to do with a young mother and a young father of two different races, where pregnancy developed and the two families were at war. And I saw multiple occasions, not always, but multiple occasions where they were at war right to the end, until they walked into the room with the newborn. And we're in the room with the newborn together, and everybody just sort of let it go. Very powerful. When I stopped delivering babies after practicing obstetrics for 13 years, I came to realize over the next year one of the things I missed most about not practicing obstetrics anymore was holding newborns, which is what I would do quite often when I was waiting at the hospital.
You know, this business of that field effect that we're talking about, this is, I've been dealing with this business in my last four books, actually, and it grows more and more important all the time. Some of the recent research on field effect is rather breathtaking, and we do know that the heart, as you know, produces an electromagnetic field which surrounds the body and extends
outside the physical body.
The what?
It extends outside the physical body.
Oh, far beyond.
Yes.
At the Institute of Heart Math and the University of Arizona down in Tucson, the group working in cardiology there found that this electromagnetic field that the heart produces extends out anywhere. Well, they used to say about 12 feet, and then they said, no, it seems to be about 15, and then, no, it seems to be about 20. It extends out indefinitely beyond the individual, and if the individual is in a solid emotional state, that is, they're emotionally coherent, that field is very powerful for that distance. And exactly that same field radiates out from the newborn.
Yes.
And when that field from the newborn is, it has to be, generally, it's coherent, and when it is given a coherent field around it to be born in, you have that newborn's own radiation field tremendously strengthened.
Yes, resonant.
By the field around it, and anyone in that field around the infant feels exactly the same empowerment. And this, to me, is one of the most fascinating things that's happened in recent research. And this is all quantifiable. That is, that you can wire these people up with detectors, brain detectors, and heart detectors, and so forth, and see exactly how it works. And there again, you have the critical importance of the emotional state of those parents and how it affects the emotional state of the infant, and they either empower each other or it can get rather negative for no reason whatsoever. There's no reason that you can't open up to you're opening up to the whole creative power of the universe. That's why I say there's a tremendous mystical, spiritual element to the business of parenting and so on. Well, I've drowned that one out.
It brings us back to what we want to dominate our life, our mind, or our heart.
Years ago, I think, in fact, it was that book, Evolution's End, in 1991, in which I spoke of the heart has one great push, and that is to maintain coherent relationship, to bring everything into harmonic relationship, and does so by trying to guide the intellect of the brain into appropriate responses. So we have the intellect of the brain and the intelligence of the heart. And if these two then go into the same entrainment pattern, you have a winning situation. But we, unfortunately, the business of the intelligence of the heart has fallen into a sentimental category, and there's no sentiment to it whatsoever. We're talking about coherency of waveforms and the power that they can take on and create around us, or the disempowering negative impact that can happen through our carelessness with our emotional state. At HeartMath Institute in California, they've really been doing some interesting work on this since about 1990. And they've had cardiologists and all those people coming into their laboratories there for 15 years now, building up this tremendous library of well-researched evidence that the connection between the heart and the brain means everything in our life, and how we should really, as adults, begin to think of the heart not as the sentiment valentines and flowers, but as the main force of intelligence in the human experience, and to come into alignment with it. And I think the research at HeartMath has outlined some pretty clear steps for actually doing this, bringing the heart and the brain into alignment. And to do that, you really do bring about some radical changes in your own life and the life of those people around you.
So you mentioned before several times through our conversation that you felt more and more there were more people, there were more pockets of people that were coming into awareness around these things over the years. And it appears that when there's more and more people, when there's a circle and more people enter the circle, then the field of that circle becomes stronger and makes it easier for other people to enter. Does that make sense?
That really is true. Unfortunately, this thing got tangled up with that so-called hundredth monkey syndrome, and Rupert Sheldrake was the one who first shot that down way back in the 80s. He said that was a misinterpretation of the research that was done. On the other hand, it's very clear that this business of a positive field effect coming from the heart has a tremendously contagious aspect to it. And the interesting thing is, if it's the field effect coming from the heart is incoherent, it indicates we are in a very negative state. And the interesting thing about that is incoherent energy will not fuse or blend in with or merge with coherent energy. And so when we allow ourselves to stay in a negative frame of mind, we are effectively isolating ourselves into our negative world. And on the other hand, by opening up to the great power of the heart, we then are opening up to a broad field of very positive energy. So this business of realizing that our indulgence in negative emotions tends to isolate us with those negative emotions and cut off the positive emotions, because positive and negative will not cohere. The actual waveforms that you can look at it on an electromagnetic feedback device, and the waveforms in a state of positive emotion are radically different than those in a negative state. And so allowing ourselves to be caught up in a negative state and staying there, and you'll be surprised how people feed their negative states as though it's their pets of theirs, and resist.
Right. When people feed a negative state, they're literally changing themselves. Because they are literally reinforcing, by feeding a negative state, they're reinforcing negative thought patterns, which literally change physical structure of neurons in the brain and chemistry patterns in the brain and sets up a state that reinforces that.
Oh, it does indeed.
Yes.
And the interesting thing about it is the clarity of this research. All of this would have 20 years ago might have sounded like hocus pocus or New Age tripe, but no, it's backed up by, I think, of one particular experience they had at HeartMath with a person all wired up and discovering that the heart had an intuitive capacity, a precognitive capacity, that it picked up negative influence before they happened in order that the person would be prepared for it. Mm. And in that respect, HeartMath ran 2,400 trials of a carefully designed experiment there in the laboratories, 2,400 trials before they published their first paper on the fact that the heart has an intuitive precognitive side to its operations in which it will keep us informed ahead of time of emergencies following. That sounds like the biggest hocus pocus, and yet it turns out to be one of the most exciting discoveries we've got going.
Hmm.
There were two scientists that set up electromagnetic detection stations 1,000 miles apart to pick up the kind of electromagnetic fields the Earth was producing and the ionosphere. And these are the electromagnetic fields that come out of the poles. And of all things, they found that in advance of natural disasters, those fields coming from the Earth changed markedly as a warning to the living populations of the Earth that there was trouble coming. Well, these are picked up by animals and not by us because we have shut off our natural communications with the heart. And I hear him telling us, Rick,
yep,
we're going to have to knock off here.
Well, the time has flown because it's been such an enjoyable conversation.
Well, I'm impressed with what you're doing. If I ever need any plastico whatever, I'll jump right down there for it.
This is Temple of Health Radio Show. We've been speaking with Joseph Chilton Pierce, his book Spiritual, his multiple books. Thank you for being with us, Joe.
Dave, thank you for having me, Rick. Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
Don't you just hate trying on bathing suits? Wait a minute, you look great. Plastic surgery?
Not surgery. I got an endermology treatment from the experts at Plastikos.
What's endermology?
Endermology is the terrific non-surgical treatment that Europeans have been using for years to tone skin and contour the body. Endermology by Plastikos feels great, and you can see the difference it makes.
No kidding. Who do I call?
Plastikos, a leader in plastic and reconstructive surgery, is the number one center in Atlanta offering endermology. For more information and a complimentary consultation and treatment, call Plastikos at 770-457-4677. Plastikos Endermology Skin Toning and Body Contouring, 770-457-4677.